Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning. Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Give me a jump the gun there for a moment in anticipation. It's Wednesday, it's February 23rd, 10 o'clock on the Eastern Seaboard, and it'll just be you and I. Today we don't have any particular guest. There's so much to cover on the international and even on the local stage. So it's really, really very important to see what's going on. I guess one of the most important, I guess, is the fact that the United States and American allies are unveiling more Russian sanctions, but they're keeping the big guns in reserve. So it seems that the United States and its allies unveiled more sanctions against Russia on Wednesday over its recognition of two separatist areas in eastern Ukraine, while making clear they were keeping tougher measures in reserve in case of a full-scale invasion by Moscow. Well, European Union sanctions to take effect on Wednesday would add all members of Russia's lower house of parliament who voted to recognize the separatist regions in Ukraine to a blacklist, freezing their assets and banning travel. Britain followed the United States in announcing new restrictions banning Russia from the issuing of new bonds in its security markets. And the steps follow measures announced on Tuesday, including freezing the approval of a new Russian gas pipeline by Germany and imposing new sanctions on Russian banks. But none of the measures announced so far directly targets President Vladimir Putin himself or is expected to have severe medium-term consequences for Moscow, which is sitting on more than $630 billion in international reserves. Oil prices eased from Tuesday's seven-year highs as it became clear the first wave of sanctions were unlikely to disrupt oil supplies. Global stocks broke a four-day slide and demand for safe haven assets waned. Western countries fear Russia plans a full-blown invasion of Ukraine after Putin announced on Monday he was recognizing two small breakaway regions controlled since 2014 by separatists viewed by the West as Moscow's proxies. And Putin also signed a decree allowing Russian forces to be deployed there. Well, Washington has described Russia's actions as the start of an invasion, quote-unquote, but because the mass military assault they predicted has not materialized, they have had to calibrate their response. And that seems like petty, to be honest with you, but so it is. There will be even more tough sanctions on key oligarchs, on key organizations in Russia, limiting Russia's access to the financial markets. If there is a full-blown invasion of Ukraine, British Foreign Ministry Secretary Liz Truss had said, well, by that time, it's too late, if you must know. She announced plans to bar Russia from issuing new foreign debt in London, a step taken years ago by the United States. Moscow said it would respond by issuing any new debt in rubles at home for now, and some Western leaders have faced criticism at home for the response so far. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson was ridiculed in Parliament when he announced a blacklisting of three billionaires already under U.S. sanctions for years and five obscure banks. Leaders say the most serious sanctions must be held in reserve to deter a larger assault. Well, it is a state of emergency, and Putin has as many as 190,000 troops near Ukraine's borders, according to U.S. estimates. More ominous signs pointed to possible war. Moscow announced it had started evacuating its diplomats from Kiev, while Ukraine declared a 30-day state of emergency and has announced the conscription of men of fighting age. Ukraine's military said one soldier had been killed and six wounded in increased shelling by pro-Russian separatists using heavy artillery, mortar bombs, and Grad rocket systems in the two breakaway areas over the previous 24 hours. And new satellite imagery showed several fresh troop and equipment deployments in western Russia and more than 100 vehicles at a small airfield in southern Belarus, which borders Ukraine, according to U.S. firm Maxar. M-A-X-A-R. So for months, Russia has presented the crisis mainly as a dispute with the West, demanding security guarantees, including a promise never to allow Ukraine to join NATO. But this week's recognition of the separatist regions was accompanied by much stronger language against Ukraine, including personally from Putin, raising Western concerns he will not stop at an intervention in the separatist areas. In a TV address on Monday described by Washington as delusional, quote unquote, that's the best they could do, well, Putin rambled across centuries of history to characterize the Ukrainian state as an artificial construct wrongly carved out of Russia by its enemies. Ukrainians consider such views ominous and false. Europe's second biggest country by area after Russia, Ukraine, has a history older than Russia's, and its people voted overwhelmingly for independence when the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991. German Foreign Minister Annalena Baerbock said Russia was making a strategic mistake by heading down a path that would make it a global pariah. The question that is taking place now may follow a strategy in the short term, but it is not a medium or long-term strategy to completely isolate yourself worldwide, she said. Now, the diplomacy of recent weeks has now faltered. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and French Foreign Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian canceled separate meetings with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. A summit between U.S. President Joe Biden and Putin, floated by France at the start of the week, now seems unlikely. Putin said he was always open to finding diplomatic solutions, but that, quote, the interests of Russia and the security of our citizens are unconditional for us, end quote. Germany said on Tuesday it was holding the $11 billion Nord Stream 2 pipeline owned by Russian state-owned gas giant Gazprom, a move likely to raise gas prices in Europe. Built and awaiting German approval, the pipeline had been set to ease the pressure on European consumers facing record energy prices, but critics include the United States have long argued it would increase Europe's energy dependence on Russia. This was reported by Reuters bureaus, writing by Peter Graf, editing by Timothy Heritage. Now, what's really interesting is that Biden, for I don't know for what intent and purpose, does not want Israeli gas to be sent into Europe via Greece, and that's a capitulation by Europe to Turkey, and so on and so forth. So it goes. The appeasement all over the world is absolutely unbelievable. That this goes on and on. So big talk, little action, very, very frightening circumstance to say the least. Well, let's move on to some other things which you may find interesting. one second. And this is important to know what's really happening. As sanctions begin, Russia's trade flow is shifting towards China. Well, it seems that the United States is poised to unleash a wider array of sanctions against Russia if Moscow escalates the conflict in Ukraine, denying key Russian financial institutions and companies access to U.S. dollar transactions and global markets for trade, energy exports, and financing. But the United States and its allies have never before attempted to cut a $1.5 trillion economy out of global commerce, and it is unclear how much pressure even unified Western sanctions can put on Moscow. A review of World Bank and United Nations trade data show that since lesser sanctions were imposed in 2014 after Russia annexed Ukraine's Crimea, China has emerged as its biggest export destination. New sanctions could prompt Russia to try to deepen its non-dollar denominated trade ties with Beijing in an effort to skirt the restrictions, said Harry Broadman, a former U.S. trade negotiator and World Bank official with China and Russia experience. Well, the problem with sanctions, especially involving an oil producer, which is what Russia is, will be leakage in the system, Broadman said. China may say, we're going to buy oil on the open market, and if it's Russian oil, so be it. Under an executive order signed by President Joe Biden on Monday, any institution in Russia's financial sector, services sector, is a target for further sanctions. And the White House said, noting that more than 80% of Russia's daily foreign exchange transactions and half its trade are conducted in dollars. Biden, in announcing an initial raft of sanctions on Tuesday to penalize Russia for ordering troops into two separatist regions in eastern Ukraine, said he would, quote, take robust action to make sure the pain of our sanctions is targeted at the Russian economy, not ours. And that may be easier said than done. With Russia among the world's top exporters of oil, natural gas, copper, aluminum, palladium, and other important commodities, oil prices hit new highs not seen since 2014 on Tuesday. Russia accounted for 1.9% of global trade in 2020, down from 2.18% in 2013, according to the World Bank data. Now, its 2020 gross domestic product ranked 11th globally between Brazil and South Korea. A review of Russian trade data in the World Bank's World International Trade Solution database shows that Russia's dependence on trade has declined over the past 20 years. Russia's export destinations have changed as well. The Netherlands was the top export destination a decade ago due to oil trade, but it has been supplanted in that role by China. Germany and Britain purchases from Russia have held largely steady, while Belarus imports have risen. China's remains Russia's top supplier of imports, with mobile phones, computers, telecommunications gear, toys, textiles, clothing, and electronics parts among top categories. Its share of Russian imports has risen since 2014, while those from Germany have declined markedly. Ukraine's exports to China fell markedly over the past decade, while Belarus's shipments have changed little. Ukraine's top exports to Russia in 2020 were aluminum oxide, railway equipment, coal, steel, and uranium, according to the World Bank data. So in this, we have reporting by David Lauder, editing by Dan Burns, and Tim Ahman of the Thomson Reuters Group. So they are definitely on top of the market on all of this. This is very, very interesting. World stocks have bounced as investors eye Putin's next steps in Ukraine. This is by Simon Jessup and Sujata Rao. Well, global stocks broke a four-day slide on Wednesday, and demand for safe haven assets waned, with investors waiting to see Russian President Vladimir Putin's next move after he sent troops into separatist regions of Ukraine. The initial push to send soldiers to Donetsk and Luhansk this week triggered coordinated yet modest sanctions from Western countries, albeit with the prospect of more to come if Moscow seeks to push further into the country. Well, after chalking up a 3.6% fall since last Monday, the MSCI World Index, a leading gauge of equity markets globally, edged off its highs to trade up 0.2%, helped by broad gains across Europe's major stock exchanges. The FTSE 100 was up 0.3%. The Pan-European Stocks STOXX Europe 600 Index rose 0.6%, bolstered by strong company earnings, including from automaker Stellantis, which is what used to be Fiat. Earlier, MSCI's Index of Asia-Pacific shares outside of Japan rose 0.4%. Standard & Poor's 500 stock futures pointed to a 0.6% higher open, rebounding after officially entering correction territory in the prior session. Quote, in the end, what investors want to know is, does this impact earnings or not? If not, the temptation to buy the dip is high, said Dirk Willer, global head of macro and asset allocation at Citibank. Markets tend to see geopolitical events as opportunities, he said, adding past years had shown this was the correct policy to adopt. Niklas Ekvall, chief executive of Swedish pension fund AP4, said the scheme had an allocation to equities of around 60% and planned to keep it there for now, eyeing a better risk return than to fixed income, which accounts for 25% of its assets. In general, the geopolitical situation in Ukraine, as long as it doesn't escalate further, will have quite a limited impact on financial markets, Ekvall had said. Then, of course, if it escalates to a full-blown war in Ukraine with further tensions into NATO, that's a different story. Commodity prices remained elevated, with traders nervous that supplies could be curtailed if the situation on Europe's eastern edge escalates. Ended its morning gains to trade up 5.8%, adding to a hefty gain a day earlier after Germany halted Russia's Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline. Brent crude, which hit seven-year highs this week, reversed course as European trade bedded in and was last down 0.6% to $96.30 a barrel, while West Texas Intermediate was down 0.6%. After their biggest jump in 3.5 years on Tuesday, wheat futures paired early losses to trade down 0.2%. Corn futures also pulled back from an eight-month high and held steady, down 0.5%. Gold pulled off its lows and was last down 0.2% at $1,894 an ounce. Well, the crisis in Ukraine and the potential for surging energy prices come on top of nerves about whether the global economy can handle rising interest rates. Citi's Wheeler said he did not expect events in Ukraine to deter central banks from tightening policy, with the investment bank sticking to a forecast for a 50 basis point hike from the U.S. Federal Reserve in March. Quote, I doubt that geopolitics will mean any major change, as the Fed are seen by many as so far behind the curve, Wheeler had said. Usually, the mantra is that high oil prices are a tax, but that's gone out the window as inflation pressures have been so strong and so underestimated by central banks. A fresh reminder of that came on Wednesday, with January Eurozone inflation data showing a 5.1% rise year on year. Meanwhile, the Bank of England Governor Andrew Bailey warned there was a clear risk high levels of inflation could prove sticky. Among European bond markets, Eurozone yields gave back early gains, with a German 10-year yield at around 0.24%. U.S. Treasuries were last at 1.97%. The Reserve Bank of New Zealand announced its third consecutive rate hike on Wednesday, lifting its benchmark cash rate by 25 basis points to 1% as expected, but surprising investors with a hawkish tone. The New Zealand dollar rose 0.8% on the news and is on its longest streak of daily gains in almost 2 years. Other currencies were fairly muted, though hopes that war in Ukraine can be avoided took some of the bid from safe havens and helped the euro rise 0.1% against the dollar. Well, additional reporting on this by Tom Westbrook. Oh, so amazing. I didn't expect this, but evidently it's here. So bear with me a moment. Okay. 1 second. All right. Let's see. We can get them in. Didn't expect this today, but evidently it's there. Okay. All right. We're going to have to get this delivery. Okay. All right, no problem. He's got a lot to say.
He's macho.
Oh, okay.
He's taken over this call forward.
Okay.
Everything is.
So it is, so it is. What are you going to do?
Are you?
Thank God, okay, I'm waiting for delivery to come up.
I your shoes.
Oh, thanks. All right.
Thank you for being understanding.
Oh, no problem. I think he's got a lot on his mind. So that's the whole thing. Thanks so much. Oh, thanks. Be well. You too. Be well. I got to go back in. Judy, all the best. Thank you. All right, folks. Let's see. All right. Totally unexpected today. So it just is what it is. And sometimes these things happen. It's unfortunate. Today was an unexpected day for this to arrive, but it has. So let me go back. Sorry about that. Let me go back to what we have here. And at least we were, you know, the interruption came at a good time, just at the end of the article. So that was very, very good, at least that much. So my apology. And let's just quickly look and see what else we can catch up with over here now. Okay. One moment here. One second. This is really, really quite important because it really puts into question exactly what Europe can do. Poland and Lithuania say that Ukraine deserves European Union candidate status due to the current security challenges. So out of Vilnius, we read that Ukraine deserves European Union candidate status, and Poland and Lithuania will support it in its goal. And the president of the two countries said in a joint declaration with the Ukrainian president on Wednesday. We emphasize, quote, that given the significant progress in the implementation of the association agreement and We emphasize that given the significant progress in the implementation of the association agreement and international reforms, as well as the current security challenges, Ukraine deserves European Union candidate status, and Lithuania and Poland will support Ukraine in achieving this goal, says the declaration signed in Kiev by Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky, Polish President Andrzej Duda, and a Lithuanian President Gitanas Nausėda. Well, the joint declaration calls on international community for a swift introduction of robust sanctions on Russia, including measures targeting the Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline between Russia and Germany. Reporting on this by Andrius Sitas in Vilnius, or Vilna, editing by Alex Richardson. Very, very compelling, and we'll see if this moves forward. It would probably be the smartest move if Europe has what it takes to do this and move forward. So it's going to be very, very interesting and compelling. Now, let me just quickly look at some other things here that you may find very interesting as well. And let's look at this. Bear with me a moment to pull this up. Okay. Arbery's killers are guilty on all federal hate crime charges. That's what it's all about. It seems out of Brunswick, Georgia. Three white men convicted of chasing down and murdering a young black man, Ahmed Arbery, as he was out jogging in their suburban Georgia community, were found guilty on Tuesday of committing federal hate crimes and other offenses in the 2020 killing. A predominantly white jury deliberated for about 4 hours over 2 days before returning the verdict against Travis McMichael, 36, his father, former police officer Gregory McMichael, 66, and a neighbor, William Roddy Bryan, 52, in U.S. District Court in Brunswick, Georgia. Ahmad will continue to rest in peace, but he will now begin to rest in power. Wanda Cooper-Jones, Ahmad's mother, said outside the courthouse after the verdict was read. All three men were found guilty of violating Arbery's civil rights by attacking him because of his race and of attempted kidnapping, capping the latest high-profile trial to probe issues of vigilantism and racial violence in America. The McMichaels were also convicted of a federal firearms charge. Brian was not charged with a weapons offense, the hate crime felony, the most serious of the charges the defendants faced, carries a maximum penalty of life in prison. The judge has not yet set a sentencing date. Now, the three men were convicted last year of murder and other crimes in state court and sentenced to life terms for the shotgun slaying of Arbery, 25, a one-time high school football star who worked for a truck washing company and his father's landscaping business. Now, prosecutors in the state derising the killing as racist, seeking only to prove that the McMichaels and Brian were responsible for his death. Cooper Jones on Tuesday rallied against the Department of Justice prosecutors who had originally reached a plea deal with the defendants to avoid a trial, as typically happens in hate crimes cases, such as the Derek Chauvin, the police officer who kneeled on George Floyd's neck and was found guilty of murdering him. In a rare move, the judge last month rejected the plea deal after Ahmaud's family implored her not to accept it. What we got today, we wouldn't have gotten today if it wasn't for the fight that the family put up, Cooper Jones said. What the Department of Justice did today, was literally made to do it today. It wasn't because of what they wanted to do. The family and supporters plan to hold a vigil on Wednesday in the neighborhood where Arbery was killed to mark the second anniversary of his murder. Arbery was shot to death on February 23, 2020 by the younger McMichael after all three defendants had chased him down in pickup trucks as the victim was out for an afternoon jog through the community of Shatilla Shores near the southeastern coastal town of Brunswick. The McMichaels insisted they did not act out of racial animus but out of self-defense and a belief that Arbery appeared suspicious when they saw him running through the streets after a series of neighborhood break-ins. The trial testimony revealed there had been no burglaries. Federal prosecutors presented testimony from 20 witnesses and other evidence they said showed that the three men had long histories of using slurs and making racist statements. The defense rested its case after calling just one witness. There was never any dispute that the younger McMichael fired his shotgun three times at Arbery at close range. The killing was captured in a graphic cell phone video recorded by Brian, a stoking public outrage when it surfaced on social media more than 2 months later with no arrests yet made, even though Travis McMichael had admitted to police at the scene that he gunned down Arbery. Civil rights activists pointed to the lag time in arrests of the three men as the latest example of law enforcement allowing white perpetrators to go unpunished in the unjustified killing of black people. Arbery's name became entwined with a host of others invoked in a summer of protests against racial injustice across the United States after Floyd, another unarmed black man, was killed in May of 2020. The federal prosecution of Arbery's killers is the first in which those who committed such a high-profile murder are facing a jury in a hate crime trial. In response to Arbery's murder, lawmakers in Georgia passed a law in 2020 that hiked punishments for hate crimes and mandated data collection on hate crimes. A year later, lawmakers overhauled the Civil War-era citizens' arrest law in an effort to prevent vigilantism. Reporting on this by Rich McKay in Brunswick, Georgia, additional reporting by Brad Brooks in Lubbock, Texas, and Tyler Clifford in New York, writing by Steve Gorman, editing by Donna Bryson, and Alistair Bell of the Thomson Reuters Group. let's just look and see what else is going on here. This is very, very interesting. Out of Minneapolis, we hear that the Minneapolis officers ignored training, lacked decency in the Floyd arrest. That's what the jury heard. This is written by Jonathan Allen. Out of St. Paul, this was yesterday, a federal prosecutor told the jury in closing arguments on Tuesday that three former Minneapolis police officers ignored their training and basic human decency by failing to intervene when their colleague knelt on George Floyd's neck during a deadly arrest. Chu Tao, 36, J. Alexander Kern, 28, and Thomas Lane, 38, have all pleaded not guilty to charges they willfully denied Floyd's constitutional right to receive medical aid in police custody during the May 2020 arrest, even as they had what a prosecutor called front row seats to Floyd's murder beside a police car parked in a Minneapolis intersection. Their lawyers in defense summation said that prosecutors had failed to prove the three men acted with deliberate indifference, arguing that the defendants were oblivious at the time to the urgency of Floyd's medical needs. Tao and Kung are also charged with willfully breaching the handcuffed 46-year-old black man's right by not intervening in their colleague Derek Chauvin's use of excessive force. Chauvin, who is white, was captured on widely seen cell phone video kneeling on Floyd's neck for more than 9 minutes as horrified onlookers begged the officers to check Floyd's pulse. Chauvin, 45, was convicted of Floyd's murder at a separate state trial last year and sentenced to 22 and a half years in prison. The federal trial in the U.S. District Court in St. Paul hinges on when an officer has a duty to intervene in a colleague's misconduct. Assistant U.S. Attorney Manda Sertich said that Tao was captured on video choosing to argue with and mock the people on the sidewalk, begging him to stop Floyd rather than trying to get Chauvin off Floyd. She said is seen smiling at a shared joke with Chauvin as Floyd died beneath them and picking gravel out of the police car's tire. Wayne could be heard worrying that they should turn Floyd on his side, but did not get up from pinning down Floyd's legs. She told the jurors, who were due to begin deliberation on Wednesday morning, that the defendants did not do what human decency and common sense required them to do to stop the slow-motion killing unfolding right in front of them. End quote. All three defendants have testified in their own defense, saying they deferred to Chauvin's 19 years of experience as the most senior officer on the scene. Lane and Kung, who pinned Floyd's legs as Tao stood nearby, keeping onlookers back, have emphasized that they were rookies only a few days out of training. Sertich argued that even the rookies should have asked Chauvin to get off Floyd or to check his neck for a pulse. They want you to accept that it is too much to ask of them to say those things, even though it was not too much for those regular people who were walking by, Sertich had said. They made the choice not to upset their colleague rather than do their duty, even though that choice resulted in the death of a human. In his summation to the jury, Kung's lawyer, Thomas Plunkett, argued that Kung should be acquitted because of his inadequate training and his lack of experience. Tao's lawyer, Robert Paul, argued that Tao knew from his training that if police find someone's heart has stopped beating, they must immediately begin performing cardiopulmonary resuscitation, or CPR, if safe. If Mr. Tao is standing there and the other three officers are monitoring and dealing with Mr. Floyd, and if he doesn't see them rolling Mr. Floyd over or doing CPR, the logical assumption from the training is that Mr. Floyd must still have a pulse, he said. Kung can be heard in body-worn camera videos telling his colleagues twice that he could not find a pulse. He told the jury he did not take from this that Floyd's heart had stopped, but decided instead that the handcuffs were preventing him from checking the pulse successfully. All three men face years in prison if convicted and are also due to stand trial in a Minneapolis court in June on state charges of aiding and abetting Floyd's murder. Lane's lawyer, Earl Gray, accused the U.S. government of railroading an innocent man in a case that has reshaped discourse about policing and race. Why did the government indict him? You know why. Politics, ladies and gentlemen, Gray said, over prosecutors' objections. He noted that Lane, not in the ambulance with the unresponsive Floyd and pumped Floyd's chest, performing CPR. How in the world could our government, the wonderful United States of America, freedom and all that, charge someone who does that? Gray asked. Think about that. Sort of scary. Reporting on this by Jonathan Allen, editing by Aurora Ellis and Alistair Bell. Unbelievable. So we'll have to see what else is going on in this world. 1 second here. One moment here. Okay. Let me move on here. One second. All right, let me just see if we have here. Okay, 1 second. Okay, this is very, very interesting. I'm going to go into the Middle East for a moment here. And evidently, archaeologists have found a 7,000-year-old ritual hunt site in the Jordanian desert. This is written by Suleiman al-Khalidi and Hamz Rabah. Out of Amman, we hear that archaeologists have discovered a 7,000-year-old stone age site in a remote desert in Jordan, with structures which show humans were rounding up and hunting gazelles much earlier than previously thought. The team of French and Jordanian experts also found over 250 artifacts at the site, including exquisite animal figurines, which they believe were used in rituals to invoke supernatural forces for successful hunts. The objects, which include two stone statues with carvings of human faces, are among some of the oldest artistic pieces ever found in the Middle East. This is a unique site where huge quantities of gazelles were hunted in complex rituals. It has no rival in the world from the Stone Age, said Wael Abu Azizeh, the co-director of the French archaeological team. The experts found converging long stone walls several kilometers long, which were used to trap the gazelles into a confined area where they could be hunted more easily. Although such structures known as desert kites can also be found elsewhere in the arid landscapes of the Middle East and Southwest Asia, these are believed to be the oldest, best preserved, and the largest, the experts had said. They attest to the rise of extremely sophisticated mass hunting strategies, unexpected in such an early time frame, said a statement by the Southeastern Badia Archaeological Project, SEBAP, working on the site since 2013. The settlement's circular hut-like dwellings and large quantities of gazelle remains show the inhabitants were not just hunting for their own needs, but were also exchanging with neighboring settlements. Tourism Minister Nayef al-Fayez, told Reuters the discoveries were a spectacular addition to Jordan's archaeological gems, which included the city of Petra, hewn out of the desert rock, the Roman city of Jerash, and castles from the Middle Ages. Reporting on this by Suleiman al-Khalidi, additional reporting by Jahad Abu Shalbak and Muat Frey, ending by Alexander Hudson. So really very, very compelling information. Who would have thought? Now, 1 second here. Okay. All right. Let's just see if we have anything more to share with you at the moment. Okay. Bear with me a second. I'm going to move on to another page. Okay, let's see if we can move here, which I think will be important. We're moving back to Ukraine. One second. Well, it seems that several Ukrainian government websites are down. Several Ukrainian state websites, including the government and foreign ministry home pages, were inaccessible today. Bracing for a possible invasion, the country also announced the mobilization of its reservists and urged its citizens to leave Russia. Ukraine has called up reservists and urged its citizens to leave Russia immediately. Ukraine's parliament has also approved a draft law allowing citizens to carry firearms. European Union slapped a first limited round of sanctions on Russia, blacklisting more politicians and banning trade between the European Union and two breakaway regions, Donetsk and Luhansk, in Ukraine. U.S. President Joe Biden slammed Moscow's order on Tuesday to deploy troops to Donetsk and Luhansk, describing it as a flagrant violation of international law. Quote, unquote. Biden also announced the first tranche of sanctions against Russia for the beginning of a Russian invasion of Ukraine, quote, unquote, and promised that more would follow if Moscow moves further into the country. This is ridiculous. Why this needs to be said is beyond me. I think they've already exceeded all of that. Germany halted the Nord Stream 2 Baltic Sea gas pipeline project, designed to double the flow of Russian gas directly to Germany, and Russia's upper house of parliament approved treaties authorizing Russia's President Vladimir Putin's request to use troops abroad. So, it seems the European leaders are going to discuss the Ukraine crisis at a special summit tomorrow. European Union leaders will meet for a special summit in Brussels on Thursday to discuss the bloc's further response to Moscow after Russian President Vladimir Putin ordered troops into breakaway regions of eastern Ukraine. Quote, it is important that we continue to be united and determined and jointly define our collective approach and actions, the head of the European Union Council grouping the bloc's member states, that said. So that's Charles Michel said in a statement today. He said that a special European Council meeting would be held on Thursday from 7 o'clock local time. It's Greenwich Mean Time. And so we'll see where all that goes. And Ukraine's minister says that banks were hit by a denial of service attack. So Ukraine's Minister of Digital Transformation said that Ukrainian banks were hit by denial of service attacks on Wednesday. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres told the General Assembly on Wednesday that the world is, quote, facing a moment of peril, end quote, over Ukraine's crisis with Russia. Quote, if the conflict in Ukraine expands, the world could see a scale and severity of need unseen for many years, he warned the body. Ukrainian government and foreign ministry and parliament websites are down. Seems that several Ukrainian state websites, including the government and foreign ministry homepages, were inaccessible on Wednesday. Ukrainian authorities said this week they had seen online warnings that hackers were preparing to launch major attacks on government agencies, banks, and the defense sector. Ukraine has suffered a string of cyber attacks that Kiev has blamed on Russia. Moscow, which is caught up in a mounting confrontation with the West over Ukraine, has denied any involvement. why that even gets the time of day is beyond me, because everybody knows it's not nothing other than the Russians who are behind it. Well, world powers, including the United States and the European Union, have announced their first round of sanctions on Russia over its recognition of two breakaway republics in Ukraine. They include blacklisting certain banks, barring American and European banks from trading Russian government bonds, and targeting individuals with asset freezes and travel bans, and that's it. So a lot of talk with very little action. And that becomes a really major, major crisis. Unbelievable. The Ukrainian leader, Volodymyr Zelensky, warned on Wednesday that the future of European security was being decided in his country's standoff with Russia. Quote, "We are united in believing that the future of European security is being decided right now, here in our home in Ukraine," Zelensky said during a joint media appearance with the visiting leaders of Poland and Lithuania. And I think he's so on target, it's absolutely mind-boggling. But that's it. And if Europe doesn't get their act together, then you could just kiss Europe goodbye and Russia will be all the way on the Atlantic. Or you know it. Unbelievable. So all these things that are going to be affecting Russia evidently is not going very far. Unbelievable. Okay. 1 second here. Okay, let's just quickly look at something here, which I think you may find interesting. Bear with me a moment. BirdLife Cyprus is seeing a worrying spike in migratory bird killings. And so a conservation group by the name of BirdLife Cyprus reported on Wednesday a worrying increase in illegal bird trappings last year, blaming authorities for reducing fines for killing protected species. This sadly comes as no surprise following a shameful relaxation of the Cyprus bird protection law in December of 2020, the group said in a statement. It has systematically monitored bird trapping levels for the past 20 years in the Republic of Cyprus and a British military base area on the Mediterranean island. Its autumn 2021 report showed a big increase in trapping levels with so-called mist nets, which within the survey area compared to 2020. Autumn is when trappers target migratory birds, especially black caps and other migrant songbirds. So late last year, activity using mist nets, which are barely visible and designed to entangle the birds, was 132% higher than for autumn of 2020. At Dhekelia, a British base area, mist netting activity showed an increase of 46% from February 2020. Last year's increase is similar to the past 4 years, but significantly lower than the peak 2016 trapping season when 2.3 million songbirds were killed. These recorded trapping levels amount to just over 600,000 birds that might have been illegally trapped and killed in the autumn of 2021 within the survey area, said BirdLife Cyprus. This troubling increase trend in trapping activity comes after a series of retrograde steps on a policy level that sent a general message of decriminalizing bird trappings. It said that fines that were reduced from 2,000 euros, that's about $2,200, to 200 euros, so that makes it about, $200, are non-deterrent and non-punitive and clearly not proportionate to the profit one could make by illegally selling these birds. The illicit trade in migratory birds is estimated at 15 million euros per year. Although it has been illegal for decades, critics blame lax enforcement. 1 second. So in a letter to the Cyprus government last October, European Commission expressed concern and urged Nicosia to annul this law amendment and restore the fine starting at 2,000 euros. It seems that poachers have used speakers to play bird songs to attract and trap migrating Eurasian black-capped birds. This is really unbelievable. The state's objective should be the protection and conservation of our natural heritage, starting from reinstating a strict and deterrent law, said the group. Cyprus is very likely to be taken to the European Union Court of Justice for the insufficient protection of migratory birds, as highlighted in the commission's letter. So very, very compelling, to say the least. It's amazing how people believe that all of this is appropriate. I just don't quite see it. More with bias and bigotry. Tunisia has withdrawn death on the Nile over the fact that an Israeli actress is involved. Tunisia has withdrawn from cinemas a new Agatha Christie adaptation, starring Israeli actress Gal Gadot, following a protest over normalization with the Jewish state, officials said on Wednesday. British director Kenneth Branagh's Death on the Nile, already banned in Kuwait and Lebanon for the same reason, will no longer be shown in cinemas across the North African country, the ministry's press office had said. Movie theaters have been showing the film since February 9, but following protests, the ministry and the Visual Arts Authority had agreed to ban it, activists and Tunisian media had said. The main actress in the film is Israeli, was trained in the Israeli army, and supports the colonization of Palestinian territory, said Kauter Saida Shebi, the head of an anti-Zionist women's movement. Cinemas in Tunis confirmed to Agence France Presse that they could no longer show the film. Gadot had, in 2014, posted on Facebook in support of Israel's offensive against Gaza. The war left 2,251 dead on the Palestinian side, the majority of them civilians, and 74 on the Israeli side, most of them soldiers. Tunisia, which hosted the Palestinian Liberation Organization from 1982 to 1994, has a long history of backing the Palestinian cause. In 2017, it banned Patty Jenkins' film Wonder Woman, also starring Gadot. Okay, so we'll see where all that goes. One second. Now, moving on to some other issues. One second. Where are we here? Let's see if this is... This is really very interesting. Evidently, a hostage in Amsterdam, in an Amsterdam-type drama, is hailed as a hero. Police hailed a hostage held by a gunman in an Apple store in Amsterdam as a hero on Wednesday after he helped end the tense, hours-long ordeal that gripped the Dutch city. A 27-year-old man carrying a handgun and a semi-automatic weapon entered the store late on Tuesday, taking a Bulgarian man hostage and demanding, hopefully this doesn't happen again. So, a 27-year-old man carrying a handgun and a semi-automatic weapon entered the store on Tuesday, taking a Bulgarian man hostage and demanding 200 million euros, that's $230 million in cryptocurrency. Police were called to the building at 5:30 p.m. after the camouflage-wearing suspect entered the store in the popular Lattice Plan neighborhood, prompting a chaotic exodus from the building. Around 70 people fled the building and 4 people hid in a closet, apparently unknown to the suspect. 5 hours later, the suspect asked for water. Footage showed the hostage bending down as the water was delivered before running out of the building, followed closely by the suspect. The suspect was then hit by a police car before a robot checked him for explosives as he lay on the ground or on the road. It lit up with lasers from police snipers. A car from the special forces reacted very adequately and alertly, Police Chief Frank Powell said in an overnight press conference hailing the hostage's bravery. The hostage has played a hero role. In a few split seconds, he escaped his hostage situation. Otherwise, it would have been an even longer night and nasty night. Seriously injured. It seems that police later confirmed that the suspect was wearing an explosive device, but that it was not primed during the incident. He was taken to hospital, seriously injured, police said, adding that a wide-ranging investigation had been launched. All options are open over a possible motive, they added, saying at least two homes around the Dutch capital had been searched. The suspect aimed an automatic weapon at police, Powell had said, as special police units arrived at the scene Tuesday and cordoned off this area around the shop. All Apple stores across the Netherlands were closed on Wednesday, and the site of Tuesday's hostage taking will remain closed on Thursday, the company had said. Leidseplein is popular with tourists and known for its lively bars and cafes. The area was quickly closed, and the restaurants, bars, and theaters were shut after the hostage taking. The incident happened close to where well-known Dutch crime reporter Peter R. de Vries was gunned down in broad daylight last year. Just when the city was about to reopen and return to normal life, violence is again emerging in the heart of Amsterdam. Deputy Mayor Rutge Groot Wasink said late on Tuesday, "Their controlled and decisive action deserves nothing but compliments," she said in a tweet. "It prevented worse," the ministry added. So very compelling sort of stuff. Now let's see what else is going on. Bear with me a moment. And let's look at something else here, which I think you'll find interesting. Moldova, then Georgia, now Ukraine, how Russia has built bridgeheads into post-Soviet space. Moscow's recognition of breakaway Ukrainian territories has prompted comparisons with past Russian operations aimed at countering Western influence and bolstering its strategic depth in the former Soviet bloc. After months of denying plans to invade Ukraine, President Vladimir Putin ordered Russia, this is amazing, I don't know what's happening here, all of a sudden, okay, let's see if we can go back. After months of denying plans to invade, Russian peacekeeping troops into the country's separatist territories of Donetsk and Luhansk on Tuesday recognized the two eastern entities, which Russian-backed rebels seized and occupied in 2014 as republics independent of Kiev. And despite the specificities of the Ukrainian crisis, analysts were quick to note that Putin's move fitted a recent pattern in Russian military operations aimed at cowing neighbors into submission and thwarting their westward aspirations, in the process halting any further eastward expansion of NATO. Kremlin has long used so-called frozen conflicts to extend its reach beyond Russian borders. In the past three decades, it has backed a pro-Russian regime in Moldova's breakaway region of Transnistria. In 2008, it launched a conventional invasion of Georgia in support of separatist governments in South Ossetia and Abkhazia, two provinces with large Russian-speaking populations. 6 years later, Russia seized Crimea from Ukraine and began supporting an insurgency of pro-Russian separatists in the Donbas. In each case, fears of a drift away from Russia's sphere of influence precipitated Moscow's actions, while the presence of ethnic Russian populations provided the Kremlin with a pretext to step in as the protector. Same logic was at play during Putin's rambling speech late on Monday, in which he claimed without evidence that Ukraine's Russian-speaking citizens were being subjected to, quote, genocide, end quote. Now, Putin's latest brazen move follows months of seesawing tensions during which the Russian president amassed a formidable army along Ukraine's borders while keeping the world guessing. In the end, the timing of his move may well have been undermined by another bizarre parallel with the Georgian conflict, this one fortuitous. In 2008, Russia's war with Georgia erupted at the start of the Beijing Summer Olympics, much to the chagrin of Chinese officials. To avoid upsetting China once more, Putin has this time waited until after the Winter Games closing ceremony, also in Beijing, before striking again in Ukraine. Putin's move signaled an eerie deja vu for Georgians still reeling from their country's bruising defeat at the hands of Russia. It came as little surprise to Professor Emil Avdaliani of the European University in Tbilisi and the Georgian think tank GeoCase. In Georgia, many of us were expecting the recognition of Donbass, two separatist entities. It was obvious to the past year or so, Avdaliani had advised. Moscow has been increasing its financing of the entities, providing Russian passports, and clandestinely increasing its military presence, and Putin's decision is a logical conclusion to the process. Russia's moves followed an established playbook, Avdaliani had added, creating or fostering separatist movements in order to preclude a neighbor from drifting toward Western institutions. With their large ethnic minorities shuffled across borders before and during Soviet times, countries lining Russia's western rim have offered fertile terrain for conflicts to emerge and fester. According to Moscow's narrative, such conflicts are rooted in its rightful claim to a sphere of influence and its duty to protect ethnic Russians from foreign aggression. Russia perceives itself as entitled to a historical sphere of influence, the so-called near abroad, and doesn't allow anyone else to infringe upon it, said Niccolo Fasola, an expert in Russian military strategy at the University of Birmingham in Britain. Quote, Russia's always anxious about foreign penetration, not only in terms of military involvement and political engagement, but also in cultural terms, Fasola had said. He pointed to the so-called color revolutions that brought pro-Western governments to power in Georgia in 2003 and Ukraine 2004, and which the Kremlin perceived as instruments of the West to drive those countries away from Russia. That rationale underpins Russia's continued presence in Moldova's breakaway province of Transnistria, where posed the Romanian language at the start of the 1990s were fiercely resisted by the region's mainly Russian-speaking population. The same concept, protecting ethnic Russians, would later give Putin a blueprint to justify interventions in Georgia and Ukraine. While Russia has stopped short of recognizing Transnistria's independence, it, quote, has weakened Moldovan sovereignty and frozen its Western integration for the past 25 years, Eric J. Grossman writes in the U.S. Army War College Quarterly. This uncertainty has served to trap Moldova in a geopolitical gray zone between East and West and forced it to act as a vehicle for Russian corruption and money laundering. Both Georgia and Ukraine are now in danger of being sucked into the same geopolitical gray zone, cornered in between their hopes of one day joining the NATO military alliance and the knowledge that Russia won't let them go. As for their respective separatist entities, recognized only by Russia, their fate is entirely dependent on Moscow. And those entities could not survive by themselves. But their fragility is actually a plus for the Russian perspective because it ties them closer to Russia, said Fasola. they would be unable to survive without Moscow's help, in turn justifying Russia's continued presence on the ground. Recognizing the two republics of the Donbas, Moscow has stuck meticulously to its tried and tested playbook, reproducing word for word the treaties of friendship and mutual assistance it had previously signed with Georgia's breakaway provinces of Abkhazia and South Ossetia. Whether those entities can prosper is a minor concern for Russia when compared with the overall strategic picture, said Fasola. Moscow will provide financial and logistical help, but at the end of the day, they are no more than tools for the achievement of Russia's strategic goals, he explained. It's all about using them as bridgeheads into the post-Soviet space instruments to control the situation on the ground. Just how much control Russia can exert remains to be seen, with critics noting that Putin's actions have hardened anti-Russian sentiments in Ukraine and Georgia. As Georgia's president, Salome Zurabishvili, recently said, her country understands very well, quote, that the people of Ukraine feel today. This is a solidarity from a country that has already suffered and is still suffering from occupation, end quote. Russia may have attained its short-term objective, but it has lost prestige and soft power, said Avdaliani. Few in Ukraine or Georgia would think about turning to Russia geopolitically. I think in the longer run, Russia has squandered the advantages it held even after the collapse of the Soviet Union. For the Kremlin strategist, however, resentment against Moscow is a price worth paying to ensure NATO's expansion is halted in its tracks. It is true that Russia's course of action since 2014 has angered the Ukrainian public and legitimized Kiev's anti-Russian posture, said Fazola. But the same government in Kiev is well aware of the fact that Russia can decide or at least strongly influence its political decisions. However, much anti-Russian they might be, they have to take into account Moscow's positions and actions. From a Western perspective, Russia's aggressive strategy has come at a clear cost for Moscow in the shape of steep sanctions, which are set to get steeper, and sharply deteriorated relations with an outraged and compact Western front. On the other hand, if we base our assessment on Moscow's stated goals, meaning the maintenance of Russian control or at least influence over those specific regions, then we can say that the Russian strategy has been successful, Fazola had cautioned. Of course, one could counter that neither Georgia nor Ukraine have given up on joining NATO, but de facto NATO membership is no longer a viable option. However much Georgia and Ukraine want to join NATO, they simply cannot. The same reasoning applies to the West, Fazola added. On paper, Western powers decide who joins NATO, but in practice, they cannot ignore Russia. Part of the crisis, that's for sure. Bear with me a moment. Let's just see what else is happening on the world stage. One second. This is very interesting. In Colombia, in a landmark ruling, Colombia has legalized abortion up to 24 weeks of pregnancy. Colombia's high court decriminalized abortion up to 24 weeks of pregnancy on Monday. In a landmark ruling for the majority Catholic country, one of only a few in Latin America that currently allows the procedure. The performance of an abortion will only be punishable when it is carried out after the 24th week of gestation, the Constitutional Court said in a statement. After that point, abortion will only be permitted in certain circumstances already established by the court, such as in cases of rape, if the health of the mother is in danger, or if the fetus has a fatal condition. For Monday's ruling, abortion was only allowed under those three conditions per a 2006 decision by the Constitutional Court. Apart from those exceptions, both women and the doctors who performed their abortions would face prison sentences ranging from 16 to 54 months. Hundreds of pro- and anti-abortion protesters gathered outside the court building in the capital of Bogota. Women wearing green scarves, the color of the pro-abortion movement, celebrated as it was announced. The court voted 5-4 to decriminalize abortion, and nearby anti-abortion protesters waved blue flags and knelt on the ground praying. Well, after the right to suffrage, this is the most important historic achievement for the life, autonomy, and full and equal realization of women, Bogota Mayor Claudia Lopez had tweeted. Colombia is now the fifth Latin American country to decriminalize abortion access, along with Argentina, Uruguay, Cuba, and Guyana. In Mexico, the procedure is authorized for up to 12 weeks in the southern state of Oaxaca, the eastern state of Veracruz, the central state of Hidalgo, and in Mexico City. Colombia is at the forefront of reproductive rights, both regionally and globally. Catalina Martinez, a lawyer for the Causa Justa organization, advised. Causa Justa sued Colombia over the unconstitutionality of the punishments for abortion. The Constitution Court studied the group's arguments for its ruling. According to information gathered by Causa Justa, about 5,500 investigations, also alleged abortions, have been conducted since 1998. About 250 women have been arrested as a result of the probes. And the feminist collective Mesa por la Vida y la Salud de las Mujeres said that since the initial decriminalization in 2006 until 2019, 346 women have been punished for having an abortion, including 85 minors. There are 24 women currently in prison for having an abortion, according to the prison authority. The Catholic Church and other religious groups in Colombia have repeatedly pushed back against decriminalizing abortion access. It is a decision that goes against life, against the family, against society. Malena Herrera, one of the anti-abortion protesters outside the courthouse, advised. Well, women's groups say there are many obstacles to getting the procedure, even if a pregnancy falls into one of the categories allowed by the 2006 ruling. Among the difficulties they allege are delays in health centers authorizing the procedure. Some doctors also object to performing abortions, forcing many women to get an illegal surgery. No organization has an official figure on how many illegal abortions are performed in Colombia per year. A 2014 study by the Health Ministry estimates that 70 women die and 132,000 suffer complications annually from unsafe abortions. It's absolutely frightening. 132,000 should be banned. That it's made illegal and causes all these ramifications to take place on that alone. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Okay, let's just see what else is happening. Okay, let me just quickly see what else is happening on the world stage. And okay. Oh, 1 second, sorry. Okay, let's just look at this. While Russian President Vladimir Putin recognized two breakaway regions of Ukraine as independent this week, pro-Russia online disinformation campaigners unleashed numerous images and videos depicting Ukraine as the aggressor. Their often crude efforts were promptly dismantled by experts and fact-checkers, but for Moscow, quantity overrides quality concerns. The disinformation examples abound on the internet. A photo of an alleged Ukrainian armored vehicle on Russian territory, a video of Ukrainian troops on an invasion, quote-unquote, mission infiltrating Russia, or another clip supposedly showing Ukrainian or Polish saboteurs trying to blow up Russian tanks. Days after the Kremlin slammed the Western hysteria over the Russian military buildup across Ukraine, the messaging from Moscow has changed following President Vladimir Putin's decision on Monday to recognize the pro-Russian self-declared republics of Donetsk and Luhansk in eastern Ukraine. The new narrative, sustained by a disinformation campaign, is focusing on presenting proof, quote-unquote, of Kiev's belligerence, which is contradictory to the situation on the ground as Ukraine confronts the military might of its huge eastern neighbor. The disinformation circulates in pro-Russian groups on the messaging service Telegram and is then relayed by state and pro-Kremlin media organizations. Over the past few days, Russian state media has insisted that Putin has ordered troops on a peacekeeping, quote-unquote, mission into eastern Ukraine to prevent what the Russian leader has called a genocide, quote-unquote, of Russian speakers by the government in Kiev. Well, the fake videos and images, though, have not escaped the attention of fact-checkers on the lookout for Russian disinformation on the Internet. Lazy, 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 lazy editing is the way it's being announced. Video of soldiers speaking Polish and trying to sabotage Russian tanks was dissected to reveal a montage of video and audio pieces, according to Elliot Higgins, founder of Belling Cat, an Austrian-based investigative site that specializes in fact-checking and open-source intelligence. Some of the footage was shot in early February while editors added footage and sound from a video shot during a Finnish military exercise in 2010. The image of an alleged Ukrainian armored vehicle supposedly advancing into Russian territory was also promptly and effectively debunked. The Soviet-era vehicle in the photo does not belong to the Ukrainian arsenal, according to investigators of Oryx, O-R-Y-X, an open-source platform specialized in military equipment and technology. They couldn't even get that right, said the group in a Twitter post. So they wrote, and Oryx wrote, in today's false flag operation in Russia, using a BTR-70-meter APC to depict a Ukrainian armored vehicle. Ukraine doesn't operate the BTR-70M. They couldn't even get that right. So far more sensitive for investigators was a claim supported by video by the FSB, one of Russia's main intelligence services, that a shell fired from Ukrainian territory destroyed a Russian outpost on the border on Monday. The FSB video was examined by investigators at the Conflict Intelligence Team, the CIT, a group of specialists in Russian military issues, and found to be suspect. The closest Ukrainian positions are located more than 37 kilometers from the impact zone, began a CIT Twitter thread in a series of posts systematically debunking the claim. CIT noted that the only Ukrainian artillery system that could fire at such a distance would have caused much heavier destruction than the one damaged hut in the video. We find the incident to be yet another in a string of poorly staged pretexts for a possible operation against Ukraine, concluded CIT in a message posted on Tuesday. Today, they write, Russia's federal security system or service, FSB, which handles Russia's border protection, announced that an unknown shell from the Ukrainian territory destroyed a border post 150 meters from the border. There is a problem with this allegation. and so on. It was not the first time that fact-checkers have called out the efforts of pro-Russian propagandists in recent days. Lazy, 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 taunted Eric Toller, a researcher at Bellingcat who monitors maiden Kremlin disinformation. The lack of sophistication may indeed be surprising. Russia is known to be a master of online propaganda since its agents interfered in the 2016 U.S. presidential campaign. Moscow had, however, and moreover, already used the same techniques in 2014 to justify the annexation of Crimea, recalled Stefan Meister, a specialist in Russian security and disinformation at the German Council of Foreign Relations, in an interview with Franz Venkat. Meister believes that it's impossible to imagine Russia today conducting a conflict without a cyber propaganda dimension. But how, then, can the well-oiled Russian machine produce such low-cost disinformation? For the moment, the Russian authorities do not need to do better, said Meister. The Kremlin wants and needs to convince its own population. A military operation in the Donbass in eastern Ukraine is much less popular with Russians than the annexation of Crimea had been in 2014, noted Valentina Shapovalova, a specialist in Russian media and propaganda at the University of Copenhagen, in an interview. Well, the authorities have therefore developed a narrative and resorted to images which are similar to the disinformation that has been sold for 8 years to the Russian-speaking population about Ukraine. Yevgeny Golovchenko, a specialist in Russian disinformation at the University of Copenhagen, told Franz Venkat. Well, it's not the first time, for instance, that Putin has used the term genocide to refer to the situation in Ukraine. This is what he had already done in 2014 before launching the invasion of Crimea, recalled Meister. This means there's little need to reinvent the wheel and fiddle with the details of disinformation. It can remain simple and work because it is primarily aimed at an already receptive audience, claims Golovchenko. So what's more, it is not so much the quality as the quantity of disinformation that matters. The goal is to create so many different and sometimes even contradictory versions of what is happening at the border that no one can really distinguish the truth from the false anymore, said Shapovalova. Using what Shapovalova calls a fog of disinformation, Moscow hopes that the Russian-speaking population from Moscow to Donbass will be so saturated with messaging that not knowing such which way to turn, they will cling to the familiar, the voice of the Kremlin. Disinformation, however crude, can also have its own raison d'etre at the international level. Moscow knows very well that the Western public will, in any case, consider anything coming from Russia as not very credible. The Kremlin is mainly interested in the fact that American and European analysts and decision makers waste time tracking down this disinformation and talking about it, said Meister. The purpose of this heavy-handed propaganda may be to divert attention to create informational background noise intended to distract the opponent. Finally, another possible explanation is that Moscow is purposefully playing Washington's game. The U.S. has warned on more than one occasion that Russia would create incidents out of thin air before any invasion or military operation in Ukraine, noted Golovchenko. All the Russian propagandists have to do is create a crude fabrication so that everyone cries wolf and spots a likely Russian false flag operation to justify a war. In short, this is enough to put pressure on Ukraine and NATO without having to move a single tank. So that's the story for us today. Tomorrow's another day. Let me quickly look and see. I don't remember who we have scheduled for tomorrow. Bear with me a moment here. 1 second. Let me quickly find that. 1 second. Here's our calendar. I'll see what's on for tomorrow. Let's see. Oh, tomorrow's Thursday, so we're going to be speaking to Brian Harrod. Yeah, we're going to speak to Brian Harrod. And then let me just quickly look here. And then on Friday, we should be able to speak to Nader Sage. I think we'll be able to do that. Okay. Because I also noticed I've got an appointment with a doctor tomorrow as well. Not tomorrow, rather on Friday. So we'll just have to see. It's in the early afternoon. I'll see how much time we can have for that particular day, or may just cancel the whole Friday show. I'm not quite sure. We may have Nader Sage and probably keep him only to a half-hour broadcast that day. Okay, so that's our story for you today. I want to thank you for being with us, that's for sure. And get back to our studio screen, and bear with me a second here, and we'll just wish you a good day. Thank you very much. Goodbye.